Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us part two for this wonderful Saturday. Anne Perry, a dear friend we have not seen for too long. Actually, when was the last time you were here? It was last fall, wasn't it?
I should think it's probably a year ago, yes.
Right. We've been very fortunate that we've become, in a way, sort of Anne's home bookstore since she moved to Los Angeles, so not very far from us. So I'm really pleased to have her back, and we are going to be looking today at her two Elena Standish books, Death in Focus, the first one, and A Question of Betrayal, the second one. So Anne, you were so excited about doing this series and being in the 1930s. Are you still pleased that you decided to do that?
Oh yes, very, very pleased, because some of the reviewers have said some very nice things to be, you know, to be taken seriously, not just a mystery. And unfortunately, history is following a similar path, which makes it very easy to say things that are probably always relevant, but pungently so at the moment.
Oh, how right you are. You know, I've always thought, having been born in 1940, how lucky I was to have escaped the 1930s, and I did not expect to suddenly be plunged into them at the other end of my life, but I swear that we're back in them.
Well, being so much older than you, I just caught the end of the 1930s, end of 1938, but I do remember most of the war, because we were all through the Blitz.
Well, yes, it was much more present for you being in England than it was for me as a child. I have very vague memories, like my mother being really unhappy with me because I got her food stamps and I cut them up for decorating things.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, I don't have any, you know, really vivid war memories because
I can remember being bombed every night.
I bet you
I can. Remember mostly being cold because we had an air raid shelter in the back garden, and cold, wet earth is very, very cold. But I can't remember being frightened because my parents never showed fear, so I didn't feel it.
Were you
I wondering? Look back now, and my memory is much sharper than it was at the time.
Right. Were you hungry?
I can remember being hungry and cold, particularly cold. And your bath, you were allowed to have a bath 2 weeks, I think, in about 2 inches of water. And I still have luxury baths, because Americans are so good at baths. I mean, I'm 5'8", and I've got one I can lie down in. And lovely hot water. And the rush of luxury has not left me yet.
I can easily imagine that would be true. Do you know, one, it's not something that you suffer from, but I have noticed that many, many Brits your age, my age, have really poor teeth. And I've always thought it was in part because it was so hard to get good nutrition as children during the war in England, particularly milk.
Well, mine are a little dental help. I mean, they're still my teeth, but there isn't one of them that hasn't had something done to it.
Well, we are actually not in the war, but Elena Standish is earlier. So where did we start? It was in
1933. I want to give myself room to expand before we actually get into the war, because I enjoy doing a completely different person. And I not only enjoy Elena, but I like the rest of her family too, and I've got plans for all of them.
I really liked her her grandfather, who comes into play in the second book.
Well, I'm so glad, because he is the only one that's actually taken from my real life. That's my father.
Is it?
Yeah, he wasn't in MI5. Actually, he was a scientific advisor to the Air Ministry and the Admiralty, and one of the minds behind the British H-bomb. But he still did work he couldn't tell us about. And I've taken all the little habits of loving the dog and making pipe cleaner animals for me, and the sort of things that give a person dimension. That's all him.
Well, let's go back to Death in Focus, because we didn't really have a big chance to talk about it. Elena has had an unfortunate affair, and that has caused her to lose her position. And what was she doing when all that came along?
She was sort of an embryo diplomat. She was in the Foreign Office, and she was looking forward to becoming something like her own father, who's a diplomat. But of course, she's not diplomatic like me.
So she falls in love with a gentleman and it doesn't go well. And in the fallout, she loses her job in the Foreign Office. So yes. You've given her an interest in photography, and so she's what, making a kind of a career out of being a photographer?
Yes, it's not what she wanted, but she has a talent at it, and what she wanted is unavailable to her at that time.
Right. Well, you know, it was still a time when it was hard for women to have, many women to have successful careers, but something in the artistic realm, you know, painting or music or chasing butterflies, whatever, but photography would have been reasonably acceptable, wouldn't it?
Yes, she could have succeeded if she hadn't ruined her career chances by having an affair with a man who turned out to be a traitor.
Right. So she, tell us a little bit about what happens with Death in Focus when we get to meet her.
Well, she's on a photographic mission in, I keep having to sort out titles because they rename them, a mission in Amalfi, which is only because I love that part of the Italian coast, and any excuse to write about it is better than none. And she finds herself very attracted to this young Englishman, and she's bored stiff by making appropriate photographs of financiers. And she leaves to go on the train home. It's a long journey from Rome to Milan to Paris to London. And he goes on the same train that he's going to Berlin. But before they get to Paris, when they're on the trip from Milan to Paris, she goes to fetch something or another and comes back and discovers that he's been stabbed and he's very close to death. And he tells her that he is MI5, which is something you never tell anybody if you are. But he has a mission in Berlin to prevent an assassination. And he asks her to take the message. All she has to do is deliver it to the British Embassy in Berlin, and the assassination will be prevented. It's an assassination of one of Hitler's main henchmen. And she thinks, well, why on earth would you want to prevent that? I'm all for it. But the key is that Britain would be blamed for it. And that would be a diplomatic incident which could be used very much to Hitler's advantage. So she delivers the message. And I won't tell you the story from there on, because that's when the real trouble begins.
Absolutely true. So in 1933, how long had Hitler, I mean, where was he in terms of rising to power? It was pretty early still.
Very early still. He'd risen in January the 30th, remember, because my mother's birthday of that year, he became leader by a massive vote, 90-something%. And he's just beginning, I mean, we're almost at the beginning of the first concentration camps, although that's not what they call them. We're beginning of the SS and a lot of black shirts in the street, or brown shirts, I've forgotten which is where. I know we started it even earlier than that with Oswald Mosley. You know, thugs in the street. And yes. Persecution of Jews. Not yet as horrendous as it becomes, but still pretty awful. And I've taken from something which actually did happen about a young man who was flayed alive. Flayed, I mean, in his skin taken off him.
In where? In England?
In Berlin.
Oh, in Berlin. Oh.
Yeah. She takes the message to Berlin and delivers it and decides that she will stay, since it's only the next day. There could be something interesting to photograph, and there is. And then she's on the run.
Well, and it turns out, as we find out in the second book, that there's some of her family history that she did not know. So when we get to A Question of Betrayal, we discover, what do we discover about her family?
Well, she has discovered that the previous story turned on the fact that her father, her grandfather, Lucas, had been high up in MI5, which was still a secret unknown by then. Apparently it wasn't made public until the 1990s. We're sort of very, very secretive. Left hand doesn't know what your right hand's doing. But she this is a grandfather that she adores, and she discovers things about him that she couldn't have known. And that may sound odd, but I mean, I'm a generation later, and I am only now discovering some things about what my father did. And I learned these from my stepbrother.
Well, I don't find it odd, because the British have always had a history of, what's the word I want to use? A lot of people who had leisure or disposable income or something were drafted into various roles, whether they're government or diplomatic or whatever, in a very kind of informal network, you know, kind of a truly an old boys kind of thing. Not that different really from in America, where it was thought that much of the SOS was recruited from like Yale, you know, a few East Coast schools. So
right, with the time and a vested interest in the society, we would hope in many cases a loyalty. Of course, in our case, it's turned out to be very often a disloyalty. But
well, you know, that's another thing that you bring out in these books, that now that we're away from it, I don't know how many people really realize how much sentiment there was pro-Nazi in England. You know, we think of England as being all united and so forth.
But no. A lot of it was led by the Holy Fox, which was the name for Lord Halifax, who later on became Foreign Secretary, I think it was. But yes, many people. Winston Churchill was a lone voice. Most of us know that Chamberlain was all for being accommodating to Hitler and believing everything he said. Churchill was a lone voice for quite a long time.
Yes, he was, and you bring that out in the book. There's a comment about how, you know, grateful that somebody is in one of the books that Churchill is out in the wilderness and not in power, you know. So, you know, do you think it was, I've often wondered at the mix of things. Part of it was a desire not to have to fight in such a terrible war again, because England's losses were so horrendous in the first
war. Well, many of our outstanding people actually served in the trenches of Anthony Eden was one, Harold Macmillan was another. He was actually injured quite badly. They'd seen it and said, well, never again, nothing could be as bad as this. Well, I'm afraid there are things that could be.
True, but I think, you know, trench warfare was a particularly vicious and cruel and completely wasting, you know, way to fight. And that when you look at so much of World War One, you know, it was fought over just a very tiny territory. It was this awful war of attrition over, you know, a very small territory, and it should have been stopped long before.
It was farcical. It just went on and on and on. And there was a time when the average life expectancy of a young man going to the front was about 2 weeks.
Yes, it was terrible. But, you know, I also have read, and I'm trying to remember, maybe it's Susan Elliot McNeil, but you might have written about it too, that many young women who were recruited in the World War II into, you know, being dropped into France and other things, their life expectancy was terribly short. Very few of them survived.
Well, one of the longest surviving, I saw something on television about her, and it practically had me in tears. She survived a long, long time, about 5 or 6 weeks.
Right. So, you know, it was really a very disposable lives kind of thing.
The courage was enormous.
Yes. So I've often thought that part of the whole appeasement thing was because nobody wanted to go back to war. But I also think that there were people who admired, you know, Hitler, admired that strongman, that fascist kind of a thing, and they were drawn to it.
But don't you think there's something in most of us that want to believe the best that we can believe? And we're good at deceiving ourselves when it'll come all right in the end. This is a necessary price for what we need.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but how do you explain Mosley, for example? Why did Oswald, he was the black shirts, I believe it is.
Yes.
What was it with Mosley and the black shirts that caused them, you know, to rally together? And they were really kind of a force for a while.
They were. And Hitler modeled his brown shirts on Mosley's black shirts. Or have I got the colors the wrong way around? Hitler modeled his anyway on ours. I don't know. I really don't know. I would like to understand, but I don't know where to turn to look at. To understand, because I know what happened afterwards. But it's very different looking at it before it goes really, really bad and looking at it with hindsight.
Yes, absolutely.
It is a pointer very, very much that any racism at all is the seed of disaster.
Well, I do think that you know, it's, you've got to recognize that there was a mix in England of loyalties and and aspirations,
and
so
it went as high up as it could go.
Yeah. So part of the problem that you're dealing with in a question of betrayal then is, you know, who is actually loyal to Britain, who might be a traitor, who might be loyal to something else. And this all came out, you know, so much later in the whole Cambridge Five and the Brits who spied for Russia, but we're now back in the 30s. So this would largely be people who spied or were willing to work with Germany. There was with Italy, were they? Wasn't it mostly Germany?
Mostly Germany, so far as I know. And remember that most of our royal family is German.
Yes.
Actually, I don't know if we've had an English king since the Norman Conquest. There have been Welsh, Scots, there have been French, there have been German. I suppose the odd Spanish, very little thrown in. But mostly, I mean, some of the royal family, going back to the time I'm writing about, actually spoke German in the home. Queen Mary was Princess May of Teck, German. The King George's were German.
Well, and, you know, Wilhelm the Kaiser in the war was Victoria's grandson because her eldest daughter had married the German emperor. So, yeah, I've always thought that was such a difficult situation, you know, where the family was on both sides.
Yes, and there must have been quite a few. It's a strange situation, and yet it has the dark side of a family quarrel as well as the pleasanter side. And sometimes family quarrels, civil wars, are bloodier than the wars with people you don't even know. And I mean only sometimes. Curiously enough, the one that Britain seems unable to forgive is the Japanese.
That is interesting. Why?
And yet very easily we take to the Germans. My father spoke German so fluently that when he went with his second wife on a trip to Germany, they kept complimenting her on her German. And finally he said, well, don't you think mind? Oh, we thought you were German. He finished his education under Heidelberg, Heisenberg, that's right, very near, in Leipzig. And one of the first things he ever taught me when I was about 3 years old, was that Nazis and Germans are not necessarily the same thing. And I've remembered that always. And I want to be very careful that I don't portray any nationality as being bad, because you're not bad because of the place you were born, or good either.
Well, and speaking of places that we go, you've gone to one of the most interesting cities in A Question of Betrayal. Elena is asked to undertake a mission to go to Trieste. And I have been, have you been to Trieste?
Yes, once.
Me too. And I found it an absolutely fascinating city. And I love the fact that you have somebody say that, you know, it's one of the most beautiful Italian cities in the book. But the truth is, Trieste has belonged to various countries and various...
Particularly Austria.
Yes. And, you know, it's a port city, so it's always had an international flavor because
and of... on the edge of the Balkan countries as well. And yes. A lot of people speak Italian, a lot of them speak German, and a lot of them speak... What do I mean?
I'm trying to remember coming up there. I think maybe Croatia is the coastal.
Yeah.
So probably is Croatia, but it wouldn't be Serbia.
Croatia. It is very beautiful, that coastline.
It is beautiful and strategic for a
yes.
lot of. But I did find, I, in fact, I was thinking when I did a little Instagram talk about your book before I came down here. And I was trying to remember if I had read any other novels set in Trieste. And the only one I can think of is Michael Pierce, who wrote this wonderful series about the Mamre-Zapt in Egypt, also wrote several books about a different character. And he was always in a different city. And one of the cities was Trieste. So far, you and he are the only two people that I am aware of who have said books in Trieste. Now, having said that, I will get 14 emails from people who will point out yes. to me.
And the thing I remember about it was the light was different from anywhere else I've been.
It does. I remember the huge square down by the water. It had an enormous square that was ringed around, very much like Lisbon, with its big square down on the water. And there were loads of cafes and people sitting, you know, in little cafes with tons of dogs running around. It was like a dog paradise there in this big square. And yet behind it, because you come down precipitously down a corniche down into Trieste, it's up against cliffs, not dissimilar to the French Riviera. So there were some beautiful places rising up at different elevations in the city and behind it that you could go and visit.
Well, I don't know Trieste well. I was just there for a very short while. But the thing that struck me, I looked at loads of photographs. The things that struck me were the light, and of course that castle, which I did not, Miramar, which I did not get to see, but I had fun with it anyway. Light on water. I remember somebody in a question session asking me what was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. And it was a high school student, and I played for time by asking what I thought was the most beautiful thing. And he said that Edgar Allan Poe had said, sight of a beautiful woman dying. I thought, flaming Nora. No, thank you. I think it's light on water, and I realize how many times you've used it, whether it's sunlight on clouds or moonlight on snow or whatever, or on a storm at sea or breaking waves or just puddles with gaslight. Any sort of light on water has a special call for me. So naturally, Trieste was good.
That's really interesting. So you must be an admirer of Turner and his marvelous seascapes.
Yes, I am.
Me too. We drove over to Los Angeles where the Getty Museum, the new Getty, not the old one, 2 years ago maybe, had a phenomenal Turner exhibition. And I am a mad Turner fan. I've, you know, visited them at the Tate and so forth. Turner, as a painter, he left his paintings to the nation as a legacy. And so there are many Turners in collections in Britain and are shared around. But I just think that he had the most extraordinary gift for light on water.
Yes, he does. And that explains why I like him, and I haven't thought of that. But do you know why his skies were so, especially his sunset skies, were so absolutely marvelous?
No, was there some sort of volcanic activity going on?
Krakatoa.
Oh, that's it, okay.
Krakatoa, you're absolutely right, which didn't surprise me, but for a couple of years after Krakatoa, we got blazing sunsets, even as far from Krakatoa as Britain is.
Well, you'll be sad but interested to know that in Phoenix, we are having that phenomenon brought to us by fires from California. The other morning,
I'm so surprised. I have only to look outside my window.
Yeah, on the other morning we got up and we looked up. It was, the sun was up a fair, and the sky was completely yellow and the sun was a blazing orange. And it was like, you know, 7:30 in the morning. It was.
It's only a white sky here. There's a little more sort of sun behind it than there was yesterday. But I've got a dear friend who lives near San Francisco, and she sent me photographs where the sky was not very different from the wall I can see behind you. Dark red.
Yes.
And I thought she made a very clever camera trick until she said, no, that is the color that the sky is here. And when it's since been in the news, a really dark red sky. It's a bit frightening.
It is frightening. I think the New York Times, it was, had a front page photo of the Golden Gate against that kind of a dark orange, dark reddish sky. So the air quality in San Francisco has to be truly awful at the moment.
Well, we're advised here not to go outside, although today's not a bad day. I mean, I can see the difference between sunlight and shadow today, and I couldn't yesterday or the day before.
Well, so how have you coped with writing during all this? If you've been caged up for months, have you been super productive?
Yes, I have. Until I got Elena 3 back to do revision notes, I was 3 weeks ahead. Now I've been just about on time, which is a nice new experience for me, because this year I've finished the years, almost. I've done a Daniel and the Christmas novella and the next year's Elena 3.
Bravo.
I know where to go.
Or brava, I should say. So when we originally talked about Elena, you seemed to like five books. When you wrote your World War I series, it was five books. Am I imagining that you were thinking of five books for Elena, or is that too few?
That's too few. I've got ideas beyond that, because I'm giving her roughly two stories a year, and I've got to bring in the abdication of Edward VIII, because I've got such an idea for that.
Oh, you do? Oh, well, yeah. You've got 3 years to go if we're in 33.
Yes, well, the 30s are full of goodness knows what, but once we come to 39, I mean, that's it, that's war. And I'm not ready for that yet. I mean, it depends how long I live and whether they want the norm or not. But I don't see an end to my pattern, because I've got ideas for Sister Margot too. Margot's friend, who just got married to a member of the Gestapo.
Yes.
I can see lots of tragedy and torn loyalties and, you know, what do we do? And what is it going to cost? But we'll do it anyway. No, I there's so much yet to explore, but I've got to explore, I think, Guernica later. That's the first bombing of civilian terror bombing. And the Italians and Germans were both in on it. I mean, there's so much. It's a time of wonderful music, dancing, films, glorious clothes, and really dancing along the razor's edge between darkness and light. If you can't get drama out of that, you just aren't trying.
Were you inspired in part by writing your quintet about World War I? Did you feel like, you know, that got you started and then this is a continuation?
I think it had to be, yes. I had a very, very nice letter from somebody just the other day saying that he understood more about the war after reading those than his own experience of his father, I think, was going. And I can still make myself weep by thinking about that.
I think it's a war. I have trouble reading about the war because I think it is so senseless and so tragic. It's a very hard war. It and Vietnam are two wars that I really don't gravitate towards reading books set in them.
I don't read other people's books in them. I don't, and that sounds silly. And I reduced myself to tears writing one myself. But I just felt as if I had to. And Joseph Reveley, the hero all the way through, is built upon, I've got photograph. I'm not sure if I can take this over to you to show you a photograph of Joseph Reveley for real, but I can't explain why it mattered so much to me, and I can't go back and reread them either. But some of the letters I've had have reduced me to tears of gratitude.
Well, I don't think you need to explain them, you know. I mean, if that was part of, you know, you have a very rich creative life, and if you were impelled to write about it, then that's all the explanation anybody needs.
Oh, well, thank you. I don't think I intend to go as far as World War II, and we'll see how many Elenas I can write that are acceptable, and how long I live, too.
Yes,
I feel absolutely fine, but, you know, the clock's ticking.
Yes, well, we both have to think about that, no question. But let's go back a bit. I'm a mad fan of your Victorian series, certainly with William and his group, and then Thomas and Charlotte, and now we have Daniel. So we didn't get to talk about the April book with Daniel. So perhaps you'd like to say a few words about that.
Remind me what it was about, because my mind's on the next one or the one after. That what came out in April, Daniel?
I'm not any help because I can't remember either. And in fact, I shouldn't have asked the question since I wasn't prepared to answer it.
I think it was Death with a Double Edge. That's what I've got a pile of these recently delivered. And that's what the iPad is standing on. Yes, that's a very complicated, story. If I move the...
No, don't do that. I'll tell you, next time we talk, we will go back and review Daniel. But do you, where are Thomas and Charlotte? Are they kind of hovering in the background as his parents?
Yes, they come into one. I think it might be the one after that. A little bit. But the next one, I won't so much, because I had Charlotte take quite a big part, and Pitt also, in the last one I wrote. I don't want to make it sort of a Charlotte and Pitt rerun, because Daniel's his own person and he's in a new century. Right. But I am planning the Daniel 5.
Already?
Well, I need to deliver it by January the 30th.
So how have you felt? Have you felt differently writing Daniel in the new century? I mean, was it a big adjustment for you, or did it seem like a natural segue?
No, it was a big adjustment, because I'm writing a very much younger person than I am now. And he seems to me to be younger. And I have to do a bit of thinking about how is the new century different. And my American agent particularly prods me with all the things that were new, all the thoughts and ideas that were new, and that he should adapt these. He should ride in a motor car, and he would be reading and taking seriously people like Freud that Thomas would never have heard of.
Well, yes, I can certainly see that. Are you planning to, assuming that he goes along, the Edwardian age clearly comes to an end in 1914. Are you planning on just writing up to that and then stopping?
Quite possibly, but it also depends very much upon my publisher. She has said, don't go into the war. So that's why I'm giving him two events a year.
Right. Well, it's so different. It was such a dramatic, it's just like walking into a concrete wall to go through the Edwardian era, and then suddenly it all blows up and nothing is ever.
Yes. I would like to. I mean, it just depends what happens. There are other things in the wind which you know about, but we'll not talk about them yet. And I may find myself only writing two books a year. I don't know.
Well, we will see. I've enjoyed Daniel. He is different than Charlotte and Pitt. And I do. You'd written Charlotte and Pitt really basically through their lives, at least from,
yes,
their initial meeting and eventual marriage, and then all the things that happened to them.
I think it's about 34 books, something like that. I was ready for a change and nothing new to say about them.
Well, it was an extraordinary run. What are you going to do with William, if anything? Because, he's earlier, because I remember the Civil War book about
yes,
him. Are you bringing him back at all, or is he kind of done?
Well, I can't do more than three books a year.
No.
Working all the time, including Sundays, and I don't think the publisher would take more anyway. So if I do anything with William, it means I've got to lose somebody else.
Ah.
And I can't lose Elena. Won't.
No, I understand. So William's on pause, and Charlotte and Pitt are gliding into their sunset years. And
well, they can be referred to every now and again in Daniel.
Right. Well, they, they deserve retirement. They've had a long and difficult stretch. I think that Thomas, you did a nice job bringing him forward in his career despite all the travels, and giving him such a senior post, and then, I would think that he would be happy to be retired.
Well, he can appear now and again, but he's retired from being the main character. I think I've said everything I mean to say about him. Of course, it's possible I could change my mind, or my publisher could change my mind. But at the moment, it's Elena that I'm really interested in exploring, a completely different, a 20th century woman.
Yeah.
She's just about my mother's generation. And leading up to the war, I can still get a good number of books out of the 30s. And we'll see what happens.
Well, I think she's a wonderful character, but I really like her family as well. So
I love Lucas, but then that's keeping my father alive.
Sure. Well, I'm looking forward
to... Go for a walk in the woods with his dog for as long as I can hold a pen.
So, PK, do we have any audience questions or comments?
Many comments from around the world.
Okay, many comments from around the world, he says.
I'm not saying hello. There was a question about how many books Anne writes a year, but I think she covered that.
She has. Okay. Well, I think we probably generally covered things. So it's been lovely to visit with you, and I will really look forward. Tell us about the Christmas novella before we stop here, because they usually come out in November.
I'm trying to remember. Oh, yes. I think it's so long since I wrote it. I think it's Celia and John Hooper from The Monks. Been married for a little while, and it's mostly from Celia's point of view. She has a problem in her church, and the minister is not measuring up to it, and she sees a disaster coming, and she does something about it.
Aha. I really like the one that you wrote where Aunt Vespasia got her own book. It was a Christmas novella, if I remember right.
Oh, did you? I'm so glad. Well, of course, I can't leave Aunt Vespasia alone.
Well,
I've gone back and read some early ones and realized I instead of growing older, she's growing younger. And I've contradicted myself several times. I know, and I don't care.
Listen, come on. I think that both of us should be delighted to be thinking about a woman who's growing younger, not older, for him.
Yes. I don't suppose it's entirely by accident. Subconscious. Maybe, but not by accident. Yeah. But she will never be through with her. I always bring her back every now and again, as long as I'm allowed to. But I went to the other extreme, the one I've just handed in, and it's all about Gracie.
Oh, is it? Wonderful.
Yes, when she's married to Tillman and she's got three little children.
Wow. Boy, there is a life that you explored from a very early stage.
She was 13 when we first met her. She's now... late 20s, maybe early 30s. She's got two little boys and a little girl who I absolutely love. I'm going to have to keep her. She's very almost six. You know how when you're those ages, you're not five, you're five and a quarter or five and a half or five and three quarters. Well, she's five, very nearly six. Wow. And she's a bossy little piece, but you've got to like her. Anyway, Gracie undertakes a rescue mission and she daren't give it up because she's promised Charlie she'll succeed. And she's called, the daughter's called Charlotte, but Charlie for short. And I already feel as if I'm going to want to know Charlie at the beginning of World War I. She's just the sort of woman that would take a motorcycle job or something like that.
Sort of an early Rosie the Riveter.
Yes, it's, you know, we did have women messengers on the Western Front in World War I. And she's just the sort of person that might do, because I've got two or three children, not counting her brothers, in this story, because many children then went into service at about 13. And this is all about a house, and it's mostly about servants. And I kind of like Charlie. I think she's keep the spirit that she's got already. And I know that Gracie thinks that she wants to give up this job she's taken, but she's promised Charlie that she'll rescue somebody, and she daren't go home without doing it.
Well, the thing about Daniel is that Aunt Vespasia at some point can't stay with us, but Gracie, who's young.
She's had to go because, goodness, I can't take her over 100. But I don't say particularly how or why. Just Daniel remembers her with great fondness and he misses her.
Yes, well, I do too. That's the only drawback to the Daniels, is that we have lost the anticipation. But it's nice that Gracie, you know, who is young, and her family are able to, you know, keep going and be part of the Daniels.
Oh, yes, yes. Besides, you can set a Christmas novel in any year you like.
Yes.
And I get back in some and forward in some, and I please myself. And as long as it pleases readers as well, that's fine.
Yes, they're really like time machines, aren't they? Where you can journey around.
Yes, and pick any character, major or minor, and go backwards or forwards with them, or to any other place. It's Christmas, do what you like.
How many of them have you written now, do you know?
I think it's about 19 or 20.
Awesome, and why did you start them? I mean, was that a sort of spur of the moment idea?
Yes, it was. Sharon Newman actually gave me an idea about medieval justice. And I thought that would make a wonderful short novel. And my agent said to me, look, nobody buys short stories or short. Make it a novella. We might manage to sell it. We sold it immediately for about five times the price we thought we'd find. And they wanted another one. And another. And another.
Sorry, PK, any other? We just have Pat coming back to check to see if there are any more comments or questions.
But the things with Christmas is you could always make it a happy ending.
Yes.
I mean, that's allowed.
Sandra Fielder would like to know, do the characters guide Anne in her writing?
So a question from a fan is, do the characters guide you in your writing? Presumably she means more than the plot.
If they don't work, they will either, well, they'll spoil it. If they do work, they might change it a little bit so that I give them a larger role. But I have to have the idea and the character before I start. The only people who tell me what to do are the publishers and agents and things like that. But the characters might give me an idea. And if it's a good one, the people who matter will go along with it. They don't tell me what to write, but they do occasionally tell me what not to write.
That's a nice distinction, Jerry, definitely. Anything else?
Just some very nice.
Just people are happy to see her, right?
Yes.
Yes, there are loads of people who are just happy to see you, who are saying hello.
Well, I will see them through your eyes, and thank you very much indeed.
It's really been a pleasure to visit with you, Anne. So maybe we can do a little Christmas chat and talk about the Christmas novella, and I'll do a little homework so that I can ask more intelligent questions.
Well, that would be very nice indeed. I'm less afraid. This is only the second Zoom one I've done. But it does seem to work.
No,
it works for everybody else. Why not for me? Except that, you know, I've got the evil touch. I can make anything go wrong mechanically.
You've done a brilliant job. Very nice. And it's wonderful to see you. We've really missed you. So this is a nice way to connect.
Well, it's a very nice way. And thank you very, very much to you for making it possible and to everybody else for making it worth it.
You're entirely welcome. Thank you all for joining us this afternoon. There will be a podcast, and you can share that with your friends or share the video with your friends. Anne has, I forgot to mention, written a lovely personal letter to our customers, and she signed it, and they will be included in each of our copies of A Question of Betrayal. So if you order one, it will be a very nice way to get something personal from Anne to add to your library.
Took it down to the mailroom today, and I telephoned Federal Express, and they'll pick it up early in the week.
Wonderful. That's grand. Thank you so much for doing that. And thank you, all of you, for spending part of Saturday with us. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.